Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. When Sadr Japarov became president of Kyrgyzstan, one of his promises was that his government would finally resolve the long-standing issues of unmarked sections of Kyrgyzstan's borders with Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. That has proven difficult to accomplish. There's been public resistance to a recent border agreement with Uzbekistan, and there have been two brief but destructive wars with Tajikistan in the last 18 months. What are the difficulties in demarcating Kyrgyzstan's border, and what does international law say about issues such as land and water rights that have been at the heart of problems between Kyrgyzstan and its southern and western neighbors? To discuss all this, I am joined by Victoria Akçurina, a lecturer at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek and author of the recently released book, Incomplete State Building in Central Asia, The State as Social Practice, and Bikit Beshimov, formerly a member of the Kyrgyz Parliament, also a former Kyrgyz ambassador to India and to the OSCE, and currently a Global Studies and International Relations lecturer and professor at Northeastern University. Thank you both for joining me. And Victoria, I'm going to start with you. Could you, I know this is asking a lot, but very briefly, could you give me a summary of the situation along Kyrgyzstan's borders with Tajikistan and Uzbekistan? What are the main obstacles to marking the remaining sections of unmarked border territory?
Yes, thank you, Bruce. Well, the situation right now is basically difficult, and it depends on how you want to look at it. Of course, the popular commentary goes that it is a matter of demarcation, and it is a matter of swapping different kinds of lands, and especially swapping land for water. However, the causes of this problem, they run much deeper than just a border issue. So yes, basically the root causes, they lie, I think they are structural, and they run deeper into history of how Fergana Valley and that, because Fergana Valley is trisected, as we all know, it's trisected by three countries, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. And therefore, it was historically evolving as a joint space, social space, we can say. However, with the emergence of the nation states in the 90s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, what we have is the clash between a fixed object, which is a national border, and then a dynamic objective, quote unquote object, which is water. So what we see is two different logics clashing there, right? Something that needs to be fixed, sovereign, and exclusive, something that creates an image of the other, something that almost needs that image of the other on the other side of the border. And then the process that connects people, especially at the grassroots community level. In more specific and more practical terms, it can also be traced back to the way waters and borders were managed during the Soviet time, right? And specifically, if we think of the three-tier system of water sharing during the Soviet time, we had the regional, then the national level, and the community level. The community level was basically managed behind the gates of the collective farms, which stopped existing, right, in the 90s. And then lands at that time, they faced the privatization process. So decollectivization process, which then translated into privatization of lands, that more or less took place and that more or less was settled. However, the waters that were in the same lands and territories at the community level, they haven't been yet managed very well. And we can say that, well, there were international efforts, for instance, water users associations and so on, which tried to create these community-based associations on water sharing across borders. But they have so far been pretty episodical, and some of them are registered but not really existing, or some of them are registered and having just one or two persons actually being members and not the entire communities. So communities at the very, very grassroots level, they remain in a way unmanaged at least the state, as in this neutral institution that is supposed to create political order, has been failing to reach out to those communities. In fact, the way the states then organized and created borders, the national borders, even disrupted what I call cross-border societal interdependence. And this societal interdependence basically is a process of bonding, is a process of connecting. While borders, national borders, sovereign borders, represent the process of separation. So you have walls facing, walls and bridges in a way, if speaking in metaphorical terms, which is why when issues appear, for instance, like today with Khambirabad and demarcation of borders, it becomes too complicated, because delimitation of borders today cannot be done without figuring out the water sharing part of it. It cannot be done peacefully without figuring out how to reconcile that structural contradiction between building bridges and building walls, right? Building, having the process of separation and having the process of connection happening at the same time. That's why this situation with border delimitation is so complicated and not so straightforward. That's why it's not just about borders. It's not just about interstate relations. It is a multi-layered issue of political order and the shared bond and the shared kind of governance, especially at the grassroots level.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
I can go on, but I'm not sure if I should first give space.
I'm actually going to get back to a couple of these points here in a minute, but I want to bring Bakit in here for a minute, because Bakit, you were a member of the government. You must have been privy to some of these discussions on border demarcation with Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. I mean, what was in your experience, or from what you hear from people in Kyrgyzstan now? I mean, what is the approach of the Kyrgyz government? I mean, what is the Kyrgyz government looking for when it starts to negotiate border deals with Tajikistan or Uzbekistan, or for that fact, Kazakhstan or China?
Thank you, first of all, Bruce, for inviting to this very interesting talk. And, it's a long process of border demarcation between these countries, and it took almost 30 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it was a serious reason for that, because this Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, they operate with different approaches, different models, how to demarcate the border. And it's a stalemate. With Uzbekistan, as Victoria said, it is a very complex issue related to the mix of land and water resources. And generally, I can say it's in this part of the world, we see the rising conflict over the natural resources, and it will continue, and probably it will bring to a very difficult and dangerous situation. But how this recent Kyrgyz rulers decided to solve this problem? First of all, they made two mistakes in their decision-making process. First, they supposed that their predecessors didn't solve this problem because they were not enough decisive. And they decided to speed up this process and to be resolutely to solve this problem. They underestimated the complexity of the issue. In the case of Tajikistan, they just brought the situation into the bloody conflicts between, because today I don't know how to solve this problem. And they are making some temporary measures, but they are even not close to the solution of this problem. With Uzbekistan, it's regarding the water resources. We created a conflict inside of the country because local Kyrgyz consumers of water, they are so angry, and they are today through the repression trying to suppress this movement. But how long they can contain these angry people? the second mistake we made, it is that we supposed that if we solve this problem, demarcate the border with Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, they will be no conflicts. No, there is no any serious evidence to think about that. Because even if they demarcate the border with Uzbekistan, sharing natural resources is still a difficult problem. Because we see on a local level, central level, how we manage the access of people to resources, problem of access to pastures, problem of sharing water resources still. And after that, we see the increasing complexity of this, because in a Fergana Valley on the Uzbek side, we see the demographic situation created kind of environment where number of water consumers is rising and the demand for water is increasing, and how we can solve a problem. And after that, we see that the shortage of water, rising shortage of water due to the speedy melt of glaciers, disappearance of groundwater resources, and so on. That's why we see very complex situation which I don't think they will be resolved soon.
Okay, thank you very much. Victoria, I want to get back to you and talk about from a legal aspect, and specifically the Khampirabad Reservoir. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what the history is of that, and what does international law say about water use from something like the reservoir like Khampirabad?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. So, yes, I would like to just follow up first on Bakit's message about the natural resources and the lack of access to pastures, etc. And that's very much so. I would agree with that. And also, people, like if we look at the complaints of people, they also complain that the lands that were around the Khampirabad, they were used for rice, for growing rice, and that's why they are afraid and unhappy of losing them, etc. However, if we really look at it from such a small, like particularistic point of view, we really lose the big picture, because it is, as I told before, it is a typical tragedy of the commons, and this is the issue that requires transnational and transborder kind of governance. And not only at the national level, it has to be developed at the community level, first of all. So in terms of international law, because you asked before, we could think about the United Nations regimes on transboundary rivers, right? For example, we could start from signing agreements and using that common good altogether, right? In terms of how legally it was done before, and how whether Khampirabad is such a straightforward or black and white issue in legal terms, well, it isn't, because when we go through the archives in the 60s, right, there are a few. There's besides the signed documents, there's also the correspondence between the ministries of Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, it's very, if we look at it, it's strictly legal terms. It's not so easy to separate and it would sound a bit absurd and Kafkaesque, but it's not easy to sort of deconstruct the land under the water, the reservoir, the territory of the reservoir itself, because of course it belongs, by all the documents, archival documents, it also belongs to Kyrgyzstan, right, as a territory, if you look at it only strictly, flatly, as a land, as a territory. Then you have the water, then you have the facilities and access to it, and then we have this whole system of how this water is used, and Bakit would correct me if I'm wrong, in terms of how, what were the quotas for Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. And so we deal here with multi-layered issue, because the human right for water doesn't really exist in Central Asia yet. What I mean by that, I mean, of course it exists in normative, in moral terms, but it doesn't in legal terms, and it doesn't in managerial, in organizational, in political, but applied political terms. in what sense that it doesn't have the legal, the communities around those waters, the shared waters in Fergana Valley, be it transboundary rivers, be it reservoirs, be it water sharing stations. And we know that in 2021 April, the conflict with Tajikistan starts with the water sharing station, right? So at least as a trigger, at least a trigger was triggered there. And then we can discuss whether it was important or not and whatnot. But the fact that water and resources are always figuring in the picture is there. So communities as such, and this roots back to how privatization of lands or decollectivization of lands happened, the communities haven't received the legal right, the legal persona when it comes to water sharing. And that's why it is a really difficult question, because water in the reservoir, even if we admit that that reservoir was built on the Kyrgyz land, but according to mutual agreements between the two countries, and even though some commentaries or most commentaries in the media say that it was built only or mainly by the Uzbek side, it's not exactly so, because the left side of the canal that goes down to the Sof River was built also by the Kyrgyz side. So it was a joint construction process. Of course, at different stages of that construction, different resources were invested, or different financial resources were invested. That's another issue. But it has been a joint project from the beginning. It has been the joint usage from the beginning, and it has been a joint management from the beginning. But here, by getting to this joint management issue, I'd like to underline that the way we understood joint management during the Soviet time and the way we understand during joint management in the time of market economy, capitalism, and neoliberal framework, those are two different kinds of joint management. And this would be another card on the negotiations table, which is problematic, which needs to be negotiated. And we need to come to the intersubjective meaning. We need to come to a joint meaning of what is joint management. What does it imply? So technically, and as I said, it would sound absurd, technically we would need to talk about the territory underwater, the water, the facilities, and the surrounding lands. And this is Kafkinsk totally. But and then the next level of negotiation would include, where does this water originate from? And it, of course, originates from the upstream lands, right? Therefore, in this case, Kyrgyzstan. So it's three Kyrgyz rivers of the Sirdarya-Amudarya basin, but they are still belonging to the basin of transboundary rivers. The problem is that on the Kyrgyz side, we tend to think that, okay, this is our river, meaning the river has a nationality, just like I do, but the river doesn't. I'm sorry. It is a transboundary river. It is a common good. It is a shared resource. However, the population and the public discourse and the commentaries somehow are not ready to think in terms of the common good, to think in terms of the shared resource, right? And to look back to the social history of that reservoir, of those rivers, of the water sharing and the lands that they are crossing, and therefore borders that they are crossing. And Bakit is totally right saying that just by border delimitation, we are not going to resolve the problem, because it's not just border, even though it is one of the most important issues on the table. Yes, and then what else? For instance, the interesting thing is that when Kempirabad was managed jointly in Soviet terms of what jointly means, and also in the post-Soviet time in the last 30 years, paradoxically, even though the lands around it are Kyrgyz lands, the access to the reservoir was provided by the Uzbek side. So there were still hindrances in terms of who governs, right? Typical Robert Dahl's who governs. What is the political authority? What are the layers of political authority? And yes, it hasn't started today. It hasn't started with today's negotiations. So nobody somehow talks about that the access was much more limited than it is now after the negotiations. So interestingly, the Uzbek side now relaxed the access, right, to that part. Whether it is somewhere legally written down, if it's legally binding at the moment to provide free access to Kyrgyz population that live in the surrounding territories, that we don't know, or I don't know. We would need to research to see the actual documents of this negotiation that nobody has really seen. But at least in practice, the access is much more relaxed at the moment for the Kyrgyz people, for the Kyrgyz side, than it was before. And this should be noted. This is an interesting development. Yeah, I don't know if I said too much, or is there anything I need to elaborate on?
Mm-hmm. And we're going to give you a chance to get to do so in just a moment here. Bakit, do you want to add anything to that? Or I have a question for you if you don't.
I give you some specific examples about complaints of local people regarding Kemperovat water reservoir. My close relatives live in Kurshab, and it's just next to this reservoir. Victoria rightly underlined one thing. Even we are thinking that if we set up joint venture, which will be responsible for management of water on this reservoir, we will not solve the following small but very complex problem. When a level of water in this reservoir go up, groundwater go up and destroying the foundation of the houses. And it is, that's why this is the main concern of a lot of local dwellers, those who live close to this reservoir. And they are not taking into account this situation a lot. And after, second thing, it is very difficult competently analyze this issue because we don't know the details. They secretly approved in a parliament yesterday this agreement. And nothing released for public, and we don't know how we would like to manage, how we would like to delimit water, how we would like to control the level of water in this reservoir, and taking into account this kind of concerns of local people about which I mentioned.
Okay, fantastic. You know, and we're gonna pick up on that point in just a second, but I think we have reached the halfway section of this Mejlis podcast. And that's my cue to remind that this is the Mejlis podcast, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinner, host of the Mejlis podcast, and our subject today is the problems marking Kyrgyzstan's borders with Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. And discussing that topic with me today are Bakit Bashimov, formerly a member of the Kyrgyz parliament, also formerly a Kyrgyz ambassador to India and an ambassador to the OSCE, currently a Global Studies and International Relations lecturer and professor at Northeastern University, and Victoria Akchurina, a lecturer at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek and author of the recently released book, Incomplete State Building in Central Asia, The State is Social Practice. Thank you both again for being on the show with me. Bakit, let's get back to you. You know, you just mentioned, and Victoria had mentioned too, that these negotiations, the deals are being cut in secret. I mean, this almost seems like a formula for disaster. Is this common practice to just negotiate with your neighbor and then inform, you know, even the people, most importantly, the people living right along the border who this affects, who have been kept in the dark that this is the new deal and they have to accept it?
I assume that Tashiev and Sadr Japarov, they are today understanding that they made a mistake regarding water reservoir, but that's why we're afraid to release information about that, and scaring that it can create a condition for uprising against them. And that's why we would like to put responsibility on the shoulders of parliament and after that to escape from this danger. It is my assumption, but When we will get details about this agreement, we can talk about that more specifically.
Okay, great. Thank you. Victoria, in your experience, because you deal with borders all over the place, right? Now, we're talking specifically about Kyrgyzstan's borders with Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, but your book and your research looks at borders all over the place. Is it common practice in your research, when you've been researching, to see that governments negotiate these kind of border demarcation deals without the input of the people in the country and without consulting the locals in along the border area?
Definitely. Not only without consulting, not even thinking about what's happening at the community level and what's happening with those, as Bucket said, small things that are not so small anymore, you know. If that territory gets flooded in the first place, it's going to be a catastrophe. Like, who is going to be responsible if that happens, right? So they don't even take into consideration how important the grassroots level is for state-society relations and for that social contract between the state and the sovereign and the people, right? So yes, definitely. For instance, to do my archival research, I had to go to Moscow, Dushanbe, and Tashkent, where I was seeing those, you know, that correspondence and so on. And paradoxically, during the Soviet times in the 20s, 30s, 50s, there were many more petitions from the communities to Moscow authorities than there are now. Now people go and protest, but I mean, more petitions were taken into consideration during the national territorial delimitation back then than now, which is a very interesting point, which only shows that communities have been really left alone. The local population in Fergana Valley has just been left to its own self-management, self-governance.
And in that sense, I think, Bruce, we need to take into account in what kind of political situation this Kyrgyz government are pushing forward their own agenda. First of all, you know that about a little bit more than 30% of electorate participated in the last presidential election. And their legitimacy is still weak. And to get support of immediate neighbors like Uzbekistan, it was at that time also very important. And it seems to me they were grabbed, occupied by these ideas how to strengthen their power and to get more legitimacy and to get more popular support. And in order to do that, we decided to just speed up this process, as I said before, not taking into account complexity of these issues and how a lot of things are really connected to that. As Victoria said, it's not only just border. It's about land, it's about water, it is about mix of a lot of problems. And if you take into account demography and the density of a population in different parts of the Fergana Valley, it is a very complicated issue. And these guys, they didn't take seriously these factors into account, and they brought the situation in that kind of a stalemate. Even if they approve and push this demarcation of border with Uzbekistan and approve this is management of Kemperabad water reservoir, it will not stop conflict. It will even put more fuel into conflict, because today, through the repression, they can stop for a while this situation, but later on people rise because on a daily basis they will start to feel that painfully, you know, not getting access to resources, rise of groundwater. They are being angry why they decided not taking into account their concerns and so on. It will create huge conflict in a very near future.
Let me follow up with that then. I ask you something. The Japarov government is trying to make the claim, the counterclaim anyway, that this is a good deal for Kyrgyzstan, that they are gaining 18,000 hectares of land, while they're only giving up the 4,500 hectares of land, part of which has the Kempirovod Reservoir on it, to Uzbekistan. But, you know, if you remember, it just, you know, not so many years ago, Urartu, right, which was the big relay station mountain, Uzbek troops occupied that several times. And it caused a big problem. Now that's clearly part of Kyrgyzstan, so it removes that problem. Is Japarov's government, are they naive in thinking that they can say, look, we're getting more land than the other side is, so we're actually winning. We removed this problem of Urartu, which has been a big thorn in our side for years and years out there, but we got to give up the reservoir. Is that, I mean, it makes it, when he says it simply like that, it sounds like Kyrgyzstan is winning, getting something, getting more than it's losing out of this. Is that untrue?
Yes, it's very simplistic approach to this situation because we're occupied by the so-called patriotic sense that they will not give up any even centimeter of the land. But what about water? What about our resources? What about the system of these resources? We are not taken. We very simplistic approach in order to get popular support. It's a populistic approach to the very extremely complex systemic issue. And this is the biggest problem. You know, we are saying, no, we get more than Uzbekistan. And then local people asking, okay, if you get war, can you just say about value of this land which we got? And after that, why are you trading this land to water reservoir? How you can justify it? Can you release your protocol signed with Uzbekistan? Can you share with us details? And what we did, we invited people and just confidentially discuss with them this issue. Some people who participate in that meeting, they openly express their angriness and their concerns. They say, no, they are trying to manipulate. They are actually cheating us and so on. They didn't convince the local leaders about that. Secondly, you know, this is conflicts on a border really escalated due to their wrong attitude to this complex issue. Sometimes it is important not to solve, but to manage this problem in order just to wait the right time to solve a problem. Let's take the situation with Tajikistan. We are operating with different maps, and we complicated this issue. We invited Russia to be mediator in that problem. And Russia has promised to share their own maps from their archives and so on. But what will be the calculus of Russia in that situation? What if Russia will use not objective approach to this, but a political approach, taking into account to whom support and why Russia interested in supporting that side against another side and so on.
Okay, thanks. We're getting close to the end, so I'm going to have to ask my last question, and then if you have any comments at the end, then please, you're free to make them. But I'm curious as on your thoughts that when we know who's what the governments are like in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, right? Rahmon's been in power for, you know, it'll be 30 years, actually, pretty soon. You know, Mirziyoyev's only been in power since 2016, but his predecessor was in the whole time. Does Kyrgyzstan work from kind of a disadvantage in any ways in their border negotiations when they talk with Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, where we know the governments are going to last a long time, and they look at Kyrgyzstan and see really, you know, six actually different governments since 2000 in the last 20 years, right? If we count elections and revolutions, is that a handicap for Kyrgyzstan going into border talks? I mean, it kind of undercuts the credibility, you know, of the negotiators sometimes when the Uzbeks think, well, we're talking with these people today, but we have no idea who's going to be there next year. You know, does that hinder or hurt Kyrgyzstan's negotiating possibilities?
You know, from Uzbek side and the Kyrgyz side, we see that they are also pushing their own approaches to this problem. Probably they are thinking that this Kyrgyz regime will not sustain for a longer time, and they are using the weaknesses of this regime and the, let's say, questionable attitude to this complex issue. We're trying to solve this problem as soon as possible, because for Uzbekistan, they are thinking it's the right time. That's why they trying to quickly legitimize all decisions reached with Kyrgyzstan.
That isn't the case with Tajikistan. Any ideas why instead of trying to get a fast agreement with the Kyrgyzstan, they seem to be rejecting any proposals. Admittedly, Kyrgyzstan has made, I remember Japarov saying that if Tajikistan wanted places like Varuk and, the enclave out there and everything, maybe they should be willing to give up part of Gorno-Badakhshan, where Kyrgyz still live to this day. Why is it so much more difficult with, or why are the Tajiks being so much more difficult than the Uzbeks?
Because Tajikistan is difficult. We see that it's due to the character of a regime in Tajikistan. And after that, by the certain nationalistic ideology. Because in Tajikistan, you'll see that during the last decades, they promoted the idea that all this land, especially Batken region, belonged to them historically. And that's why they would like just to, establish the historical justice and so on. And the local people very much occupied by these ideas. When we analyze social networks where Tajiks discuss on this problem, we can see that it's very visible. And the Tajik regime is fragile, and we're trying to maneuver between the different groups. And even being very dictatorial, this regime cannot control different forces inside of the country, in army, in police, and so on. And therefore, even some groups using foreigners to attack Kyrgyz territory. And we saw it. And there is evidence of that. But why Tashiev decided to, to play the game on the side of a Tajik, saying that we will attack not by the Tajikistan, but by the unknown people, it's still puzzling. And we see that both sides preparing to the next conflict. And in that situation, we can say that the next conflict is becoming almost inevitable.
Okay, well, I'll open up the floor. Victoria, do you want to make any comments on this before we close this session out?
Yes, I probably do. I mean, I'd like to just follow up on what Bakit was saying in terms of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and again, the issue of Ungarto and the issue of continuity of regimes and so on. So I would say that the fact that this fear that any regime would the frequent change of regime in Kyrgyzstan is a problem because they don't trust. I actually would say there's a lot of continuity in the regimes regardless of the change of the elites. Like when you have the upheaval, it doesn't mean you have a revolution. Revolution requires a change of the system, of structures, of institutions, etc., which haven't been changed in Kyrgyzstan. If at all, they were actually getting backwards towards the more, well, for example, towards, again, the presidential form of governance, etc. So even if we take it to the issue of border delimitation, Ungarto issue was discussed and sort of, I don't know if we can use the term resolved to that, but it was discussed first during 2001-2008 period, right? So it's a totally different government, and we could say it was discussed during another regime, or Bakiyev's regime, or so on, also Akayev's and then Bakiyev. So during both regimes, these issues were discussed, and it seems like that actually these new negotiations, they didn't bring too much news. In a way, they just restated or maintained the status quo that was achieved during the previous regimes, which only proves that this has not been a real revolution. So I am not sure I would see Kyrgyzstan as unstable if we think of it in that way, you know, if we think of it in terms of the system and systemic change rather than elite and elite change. Just changing one person doesn't mean the systemic change is happening. So, and maybe that's why they are afraid to show the actual documents to the population, because part of them would, I mean, as I said, that's a bit of a speculation on my side, given that we haven't seen the secret documents. But part of that fear could be that people would see that that's what Bakiyev decided or his government decided and not the today's government. So it would kind of undermine this legitimacy of this whole new, fresh, quote-unquote revolutionary regime, you know. That's one comment. The other one is about Tajikistan and Voruch and that. In that sense, Tajikistan is indeed being more difficult, but the main problem in that negotiation and in the popular commentaries in the media is that it seems like the problem is Voruch. Like Tajik side is saying, no, it's ours, Kyrgyz side. The narrative developed, the latest development of the narrative is also about that it's our territory. In fact, initially, Voruch is Tajik territory, but it is an enclave surrounded by Kyrgyz territories, right? So it's nobody, Kyrgyzstan initially never claimed the rights for Voruch as such. So why is Tajik side making it sound like somebody is trying to deprive them of Voruch? This is a big question, right? What the real, so you see the why narrative becomes so important, that it's getting the life of its own. It makes the issue out of nothing. Like in a way, nobody had claims over Voruch as enclave, but the real problem was the road, right? The road that connects Kyrgyz territories to Kyrgyz territories and Tajiks to Tajik mainland through Kyrgyz territories, etc. And that road was also jointly built and managed, right? So if we go down and trace back the where it all the discussion started, it was about the road. It was about the creeping migration and this kind of sporadic moving of fences and houses towards Kyrgyz territory. So the issue was that when Kyrgyzstan was asking, hey, if you are moving, if you have built a village on our territory, maybe let's talk about swapping some other, exactly the same amount of territory for another, on some other, you know, territory. It might include parts of Voruch, but nobody really claimed or had this on the table initially. It's what narrative did later, and the problem is that it's becoming that problem. However, another paradoxical thing, even though right now Tajikistan is trying to get weapon from Iran and support of militarize and find the support to militarize themselves, the after this latest conflict, these borders somehow I'm sure we all saw the decision to demilitarize the borders and sort of remove the border guards, the the posts. Why is that happening after such a huge infighting, right, when so many people have suffered? Why do we need to remove borders right at this moment, not before, when we needed the actual use of lands and the actual use of water for people, communities, and so on, but right after the infighting? It creates a hypothesis that both of it, it's the elite project. It has nothing to do with one state fighting another state or one society going against the other. And I would like to underline that my point is that giving the narrative this interstate power is very dangerous, because it turns a problem which is about something else, right, into an interstate, I'm afraid of this word, war. Right? And this is dangerous. Like, and especially by demilitarizing it at this moment, or even removing border guards whatsoever, while gaining and buying weapon meanwhile. What is going on? What is going on? And of course, this brings us to the hypothesis that, okay, Fergana Valley is a hub for anything, any informal illicit trafficking there is. Also legal one, but illicit as well. So where is that on the picture? You know, maybe that's the control over that trafficking we need, whatever, you know, elites might need, or maybe not. Like, but it definitely tells us that they don't care about people. And this is the problem. We lose the social component, the humanitarian component, the grassroots component in all of this. And that's dangerous.
This is, Bruce, may I add what Victoria said? I would like to pick up her last sentence regarding grassroots level. You know, we will understand this situation more better on local level and afterward on central level if we take into account the following factors about which we unfortunately don't have enough information. First of all, about cattle from both sides and their access to pastures, regarding Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Second, how we are sharing water resources, what we are doing. Secondly, transportation, with intensity of this transportation. Housing in that part of the world. Demography along the border, and the Tajikistan side is one picture and the Kyrgyz side is another picture. I can assume that probably someone in a Tajik government thinking if they create a constant tension in along the border, they will push Kyrgyz families out of a border. And through this, they can just make this land available for them, probably, because this kind of ideas I discovered in the different social networks and interviews of some officials. And after that, Victoria is right, saying it's not only about Voruch. Voruch is just one part of a problem and small part of the problem. It's again a mix of a lot of factors which we need to examine more carefully. And we should not afraid to use the possibility of interstate war, because statistics during the last two decades shows that intensity increasing and the number of officials and policemen and soldiers involved in this conflict is going up. And it's creating condition for local war between these two states. And after that, we need to take into account that how dangerous both regimes. Both regimes were populistic and authoritarian regimes. And that's why it's very hard to predict how they can act in the next months. And in order to survive, they can even get mobilized support for themselves. They can go to anything. And they are already doing that. They are collecting weapons. They are preparing to the next conflict. And when one another issue, in 2009, we got the picture regarding the drug trafficking through these checkpoints. And, you know, higher officials were involved in that. And we even got the picture of son of Bakiev who personally came to do that. And after that, I mistakenly announced prematurely this thing, and my house was raided by the police, and they took everything from my house in 2009. And I told about them in my interview what happened. This is what is going on in Kyrgyzstan. It's to some extent, it's a continuation of Bakiev's regime. But this government getting more dangerous.
No, yeah, I definitely Yeah. Sorry, Bruce, we got really into this. I have more comments, but if we have to stop, we'll stop.
We could talk about this for a long, long time. If you want to get in one more comment, Victoria, go ahead, but we should probably wrap this up pretty soon.
Okay, I'll try to be quick. So three things. I would like to totally agree with Bucket on this point as well. And I just want to kind of have a final conclusion in that we need to, as in the narrative, like especially media, journalists, you know, those who make the public opinion, it's very important to keep the humanitarian cause and human rights in mind, also human rights for water, human rights for land, you know, those kinds of human rights that we don't talk much about, okay? And we also need to keep in mind that this narrative of inter-ethnic conflict or interstate conflict, it is very dangerous. It is getting the life of its own. And the conditions for war, unfortunately, seem to become real. But the problem is that it's not going to be Tajik people fighting Kyrgyz people, because I lived in that area too, and also in the enclaves, in Voruch. And people always told me they feel more sense of belonging with their Kyrgyz neighbor on the other side of that road that we were discussing, you know, that they watch Kyrgyz television, they speak some of the Kyrgyz language, and they feel more disconnected from their central states, right? So what we need to understand is that there is a connection within Fergana Valley, or there was at least a connection within Fergana Valley among all these multi-layered communities. It's not that clear-cut over there, who is Tajik, who is Uzbek, who is Kyrgyz, who is whatever. I mean, it is on some formal level, but it isn't if we look at the practice of joint share, of common sharing, etc. You know, and this social history and this societal interdependence is very important, because what the elites are trying to do, they're breaking that. They're breaking that common social space by, yes, as Bucket said, by populist means. We should keep that in mind and underline this as much as possible so that people do not turn against each other, even if their governments do. And my second point is that this tragedy of the commons is about this shared resource, shared space even, you know, the social space that we share over there. But it's not necessarily neo-Malthusian. It's not that we lack resources. We have enough, but we lack good governance, transnationally, cross-border, grassroots kind of governance, you know? And my final last point is that, okay, everyone, be it civil activists or, you know, protesters, they focus on Kempirabad and that kind of injustice in terms of water, quote unquote, right? But what about situations when elites, they trade water privately, just bottling that and trading them to, say, whatever, Middle East, Gulf, etc. So it happened during Bakiyev's time. And even up to date, the legislation doesn't include water as a commodity. It's literally that formulation when I saw it in the legislation. So again, legally, they are not, it's not prohibited to make commodity out of water, but also commodity privately, you know, without consulting with people, without making it. So when it comes to this external other, we make it about us and them for some reason. You know, but when it comes to the local problems that societies, both or all three of them, have, where these things disappear, why some groups are allowed to use water or national resources as a commodity and some are not, etc. So where is the nation in that case then? If there is, then it should always be there, whatever is the other, the image of the other. So, but as I said, it's better to, I hope we will try to sign up to the UN regime on transboundary rivers. I hope we will raise awareness in terms of the common good, and we will raise awareness of this shared social space rather than continue the narrative of inter-ethnic, inter-state, inter, you know. We need to look at the bonds rather than separations, at the bridges rather than walls. Yeah, and I stop here. Thank you so much.
Yes. Of course, it's. I agree with you, Victoria. But in reality, we can see that people-to-people diplomacy doesn't work in that region. Secondly, ordinary people who are living next to each other during the conflict, they are participating violently in that conflict. Thirdly, they can solve this problem by just very good management and very positive attitude to each other, but they are not doing that. And we need to think also of the implications of these authoritarian, populistic, nationalistic regimes to the common sense of ordinary people on a local level. Unfortunately, we were gravitated by these wrong ideas, and instead of just to solve a problem by themselves, they are participants of these dangerous conflicts. This is what's going on in reality.
Okay, wow. You know, we could go on with this conversation for a long time, and there's certainly a lot more to say to this, but unfortunately, we haven't speaking for an hour. Actually, fortunately, it was good. It was a good hour. Like I said, thank you. But I do have to wrap this up. I have to let Nathan go. And I know Victoria's got to go to sleep here pretty soon. And Bikit, you have courses that you need to go to. So I'll just say excellent discussion. Thank you very much, Victoria and Bikit. And a huge thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to Mejlis Podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting RFARL's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.